And be sure to look for Current State next Friday, the 7th. We'll be doing our program live in our 6 p.m. hour, 6 p.m. to 7, 1 week from tomorrow, the 7th, in downtown East Lansing from the Great Lakes Folk Festival, where we'll have live music and interviews happening in the city parking lot right across the street from Harper's. So a chance to take in the Great Lakes Folk Festival and join us. Stop by, say hi. Garrison Keeler and a Prairie Home Companion is coming to Wharton Center tonight at 7:30 p.m. And once again here today, Current State has two pairs of tickets to offer to the show. Once again, let's take caller 4 and caller number 5 now to WKAR. The number to call is 517-884-4700. 517-884-4700. That's for tonight at the Wharton Center. At the top of our program today, recently, Lansing School District officials acknowledged that an effort to save $750,000 in transportation costs fell seriously short. Last year, the district outsourced its bus transportation to Lansing's Dean Transportation, projecting a savings of $760,000. The district says it ended up saving about $6,000. With the district currently accepting bids to contract out custodial and other work, I sat down yesterday with Peter Spadafor, president of the Lansing School Board, to learn more. I first asked him to walk us through why hundreds of thousands of dollars in savings failed to materialize after the bus outsourcing.
Sure. To say failed to is a little bit of a misnomer. We did, in fact, add cost to the busing situation in the Lansing School District. We added 11 routes that weren't initially bid by the consortium. So that added about $285,000 in costs that we would have had whether we went with the consortium or ran our busing program ourselves. We also failed to provide some routing data to the consortium when we initially bid out the project. So that was unexpected as well. And I'll talk of those 11 buses were part of the extended day program at Eastern High School that was part of the turnaround plan for that school. So what it did is it moved the start time of Eastern 2 hours forward on Wednesdays, resulting in additional bus runs. And you've got to pay for those somehow. So those were costs that we incurred on our own. One of the other reasons was we saw that the consortium billed not as regularly as we thought, so we weren't able to catch the overage in time to reverse it. So we have asked the consortium, Dean Transportation, and our operations department to pay more close attention. But I do want to talk a little bit about the reasons that we went with the consortium. They were not purely financial. There's a level of service that we were hoping to provide our students and our families in the Lansing School District that we didn't think we were providing while running our own transportation department. So by consolidating into a professional organization that's sole purpose is to transport students, we're able to provide a higher level of service, a higher on-time rate.
Were you still expecting to see a net savings, though, of $760,000?
That was anticipated, yes. But as I said, there were some costs that we neglected to properly account for. We are still going to lean on the consortium to produce those savings. We view a lot of those overages at one-time costs that we can anticipate this time around. We won't be adding routes. In fact, the district is going to a district-wide late start on Wednesdays, so that will alleviate $285,000 in costs that weren't part of the original proposal as well. We did still save, you know, $6,000. It's not a lot of money in a $160 million budget, but we also received $1.5 million for our fleet. We deferred maintenance that we would not have to replace some buses. We had put off replacing a number of buses for a number of years. And every bus that we have to replace is about $80,000, give or take. So those are things that you're not necessarily reported on the front page, but they're things that we consider when we make those types of decisions as a school board.
What did get reported on the front page, literally, though, was inaccurate bus routes, according to the Lansing State Journal, were at least in part responsible for this $750,000 unanticipated $750,000 expense. Why weren't the bus routes that Dean got accurate? I mean, that sounds inexcusable.
That sounds exactly right. We've asked the administration to look into that, and people have actually been, brought to task on that. That's something the school board was not very happy about to hear. You know, if we heard that all $750,000 was because we added service, that's something that's a little bit easier to swallow rather than, oops, we sent the wrong info over. So we've asked the administration to look into that. The folks that did provide that information, some of them aren't even in the district anymore. So it's all happened in the past. We're looking at moving forward. We have been overall very happy with our arrangement with the consortium. We view this as a long-term arrangement as well. So you've got a number of districts participating in this consortium. It allows us to consolidate that so we don't have 7, 8, 10 transportation directors throughout the county.
Any ramifications or disciplinary action considered for the people responsible? Are the key people responsible still with the district?
We've had a few folks turn over, but no one has lost their job over this. This is some of the things that were unanticipated, and we have a very complicated transportation system. $760,000 is a lot of money, but we also have spent a lot of that money on enhanced services to students. So some of that is not what I would consider negative. $285,000 of that or more is routes we added to the system.
Who ran the transportation department when the maps were submitted to Dean?
This was only the operations division, and I can't give you the name of the person because I can't remember what year we submitted the transportation routes and whatnot, so I'd have to get back to you on that.
Peter Spadafore is our guest. Peter's the president of the Lansing School District Board of Education. We're talking about efforts, not always successful here, to privatize school services and other issues. Hindsight being 2020, if you had to vote over again on the bus outsourcing proposal, would you vote for it or against it?
This has absolutely been a successful program. We've seen enhanced service and more reliable transportation for our students, so that's a win in Lansing. I would be a yes again.
How should this have been handled differently, though?
You know, I'm not going to spend a lot of time reflecting on that, but I do think we've made some changes to ensure that this doesn't happen again. We have a better routing software now. We're working with the ISD to better understand our routes. We will be utilizing better ridership policies, and we'll be using hubs and a more district-wide calendar to ensure that bus routes are all streamlined across the district. So I think we've made a number of changes to address some of the concerns that have come out of this experience.
I'm wondering if you can clarify one detail in the State Journal's treatment of the transportation story, that there are 500 to 600 homeless children attending Lansing Public Schools. Is that number accurate?
Yes. We have a high homeless population in the city, and we transport those students. Under the old system, we relied on district-owned buses, a contract with a cab company here in town, and our own transportation.
But this is homeless in a way that an adult would be considered homeless? Nowhere to sleep homeless?
Varying levels of homelessness, yes. We pick up from shelters. We pick up from distant relatives' home where they're using as an address, a lot of different things like that. We have a homelessness situation in the city of Lansing, and we do our best to make sure that those students that are in that situation get the same education that every other student in the district gets.
500 to 600. What's the total enrollment of the district?
We're a little over 11,000 students.
That is, I found that amazing, and I had to try to clarify. There is another phase of privatization that's happening. The district is currently taking bids, I understand, on a facilities management contract. What would that cover?
Sure. That has gone out. There's an RFP out there sitting on our website, and vendors have a chance to respond. I believe they're doing interviews next week. What that will entail is custodial, grounds maintenance, facilities management, so things like dealing with the boilers and ordering supplies for cleaning and taking care of our facilities. We've had some issues with getting the grass mowed in a lot of places, or we've got some open custodial positions. We've got to do our due diligence to take a look at these options. We've put out an RFP. Our contract is up right now for those services within the district. This is the time to do those types of exploratory exercises.
Does the unexpected outcome of the transportation contract with Dean give you any pause over outsourcing facilities management?
You know, like I said, we want to make sure we have all our information correct, like we did, like we want to with the buses going forward. So we will be doing a very strong evaluation of what our costs truly are right now and what the operation looks like. It does make me want to, do an extra round check over the RFP, the, I'm sorry, the proposals that come in. But as I said, I've had a positive impression of our experience with the ISD Transportation Consortium. So I'm waiting to make a decision on this until we've seen all the data from the administration and those that present proposals to us.
You also serve as a co-chair of a bond committee that's looking at pretty comprehensive changes in the district, Eastern students to the Patton Gill building, and a host of other moves. It's called, as you referred to it, the Pathway Promise. What's at the heart of the Pathway Promise?
At the heart of the Pathway Promise is making sure that we prepare every student for their post-secondary options. You know, we have the promise here in Lansing, and we want to develop pathways that get students to those promises so that they're utilizing that those promise dollars at higher education institutions, community colleges, vocational training, those types of things. So what we're hoping to do is develop an academic model that clearly spells out from pre-kindergarten until you leave the Lansing School District the options available to you and the pathways we'd recommend you take to fully realize those options. And we need to then address our facilities. You know, most of our buildings are eligible for AARP membership. The average age is over 55. So we're looking at renovating district-wide these buildings to make them suitable for a 21st century learning environment. And that's just not possible in some of our spaces. So the bond committee, and I want to be clear too, the bond committee has made some recommendations to the board, and the board is now thinking on those and deliberating. We had an extensive discussion at our retreat Saturday about, you know, questions about this proposal, things we might do differently if it was up to, you know, and it is up to the board, but in our final decision. But the proposal from the bond committee comes up with three high schools and three distinct pathways that would require about $120 million in renovations. That includes adding on to what is currently called Patton Gill Middle School and the deacquisition of the Pennsylvania property that currently houses Eastern High School. The proposal that was put before the board would move the Eastern High School from Pennsylvania to the current Patton Gill building, and then move the Patton Gill Middle School over to a K-8 building on the current Fairview site and then renovate that. It also calls for renovations at a number of our schools, including Sexton and Everett.
What do you say to critics who have maintained that the Lansing should only have two high schools and not three? This would keep three, obviously.
Yeah, this would keep three. We are still deliberating on that. The bond committee thought three was the way to go, and it fits with the Pathway Promise that is the academic plan that's driving these changes. The board has had some discussions about the possibility of going down to two high schools. It's not off the table yet. I wouldn't say it's a certainty, and I wouldn't say this Pathway Promise is a certainty, but what is certain is we have a timeline in front of us that the board will have to take a look at to get a bond proposal on the ballot for May of 2016.
Peter Spadafore has been our guest. Peter's the president of the Lansing School District Board of Education. We've been talking about privatization, outsourcing, and of course the Pathway Promise. Thanks for joining us. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR and AM 870 WKAR. We are also always online at WKAR.org. The Michigan Capitol Building is a popular and picturesque meeting spot in downtown Lansing. Its grassy east lawn is adorned with shade trees and historic war memorials. It's not surprising, then, that dozens of people parked alongside Capitol Avenue this week. Not their cars, mind you, themselves. For 2 days, the very street itself became an urban oasis for children playing games and workers playing a little hooky. The Michigan Municipal League sponsored the project called Convert Capitol Avenue. It's designed to encourage people to imagine a more pedestrian-friendly downtown Lansing. Current State's Kevin Labrie met with project organizer Derek Tisler on the avenue, where parking spaces were transformed into parklets.
We really wanted to focus on making the street more lively, more people-friendly, more interactive, and less just built for cars. So as part of this project this week, on Tuesday and Wednesday, we organized parklets, which are small public spaces located in the metered parking spaces along the road. And we thought having a little parklet right there in the road would spark a conversation about the street, and it would get people thinking about the current public spaces that we have. With the street being the most important public space that most downtowns have, we wanted to use that space. We wanted to give some of it back to the people and give some of it back to really enjoying your time downtown.
Derek, take me on a walk down Capitol Avenue. Let's see who's here and what they're doing, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to. The first thing, right north of Michigan Avenue here, this is actually the Michigan Municipal League's parklet. We just wanted a fun, interactive space. We have a sandbox here. We have some fake grass set. We wanted it to be really comfortable, a place for people to lounge outside, maybe take a break from work, have conversations with new people about new things. That's the idea there.
This does look mildly dangerous. We are pretty close to the traffic.
Safety was a huge concern for us. And that's why we decided not only to close off the parking lane, but we closed off the driving lane next to it. So there's a good 6, 7, 8 foot buffer there. And we wanted that to be a barrier. We wanted to make it clear this space is for people and the space on the other side is for cars. And we haven't had any complaints about it so far.
I'm Tomiko Rothorn.
Are we watching at least Lansing's biggest Connect Four game in front of us?
I do think this is the biggest Connect Four game I've ever seen, for sure.
It's an international competition. It's Germany against the U.S.
Mine's the American girl. We're rooting for green.
How did you find out about the parklets?
We saw the story that was in the Lansing State Journal, and we had these guests from out of town, from Europe, visiting us, so we thought it'd be a fun thing to come and check out. Show them the Capitol, show them a little bit of Lansing.
Stephanie, what do you think of Lansing so far?
Oh, it's great. I've actually been here 25 years ago as an exchange student, with Tomiko being my host sister. So we're now back visiting with our kids, and it's great to be back.
Is Connect Four the cultural phenomenon, the rage in Germany the way it is here?
Probably. We also play soccer, you know, with this football. And
I've heard of it. I understand it's pretty popular in Europe.
It is.
Would you like a s'more? I made a nice fresh s'more for you here.
We're making s'mores right here outside the Capitol.
Yes, we are. We got a little campfire, got a campsite, a dog in a canoe right here on Capitol Avenue.
That's almost a rhyme.
Thanks. Accident. I'm Brad Garman with the Michigan Environmental Council.
You guys have a parklet here, and you've got some lawn chairs or beach chairs, looks like, set up. What kind of comments are you getting from people so far?
People seem to really like the, it raises awareness of what this kind of space is. It's bigger than you think. A parking space doesn't seem big when you put a car in it, but we've managed to put a hammock, a campfire, a whole set, and a canoe, all in the couple spaces that are here, and I think people are really enjoying it. We've had some kids toast some marshmallows. We got ladder golf behind us. And they seem to really be enjoying it. It's a nice little event.
It's too bad you can't do this every day of the week all the time.
Well, that is kind of the vision here, is how do we convert Capitol Avenue, and how do we think about our public spaces and our infrastructure as places that don't just serve cars getting in and out of downtown, but as places for people and places that people can enjoy the day. We've had some state employees that come out and say, can I just use this space and get some work done? It's more comfortable to sit under a tree and comfy recliner chair than it is to sit in an office. So I think we're getting good compliments, and I think it is changing the way maybe people think about kind of the big giant spaces of asphalt that we've got and what they could be doing instead.
I'm Lauren Hansis.
And this is Grand Grilling?
Grand Grilling, yes.
What do you specialize in?
We sell chicken wraps, salads, and rice bowls.
There's this event right across the street from us here. People are set up with camping chairs and just enjoying the day. Is that drumming up business for you guys that you wouldn't normally get?
It is, and tomorrow's the farmer's market, so that'll bring even more business in. And everyone's coming together, and they're getting food, they're enjoying themselves. So it's nice, and it's bringing business. So that's a plus. Ready?
Yeah, watch out.
I'm trying to see where the fun is for you.
It's good exercise. It's great being outside.
Not my first choice for a playground, but I guess it works today.
Hey, it works. You can play anywhere.
Let me quick get your name, if you don't mind.
Ann Conklin, Michigan Recreation and Park Association.
What do you call this serpentine thing here?
It's called a reflex. It's today's version of a teeter-totter, and our friends at Miracle Midwest donated the use of this.
And you've got some artificial, well, it looks like sod here.
This is sod. Real. Hey, this is a park. We got the real stuff.
bite my tongue for suggesting AstroTurf in a real park.
That's right. At a real park, we've got to have real grass.
What kind of reception are you getting so far?
It's been fabulous. What a great day this is. What a great event to show that how important public spaces are to communities. It's just absolutely wonderful.
What do you think this might become, Anne? I mean, the spark has been ignited here to get people thinking about revitalizing their downtown. Perhaps an organization like yours could jump in and play a role.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, we want to be key players in making sure that urban areas have great places, public spaces for people to play, green spaces to enjoy. We think it's really important, and we're strong advocates of that, and we'll do whatever we can to make it happen.
I'm back now with Derek Tisler with the Michigan Municipal League here on Capitol Avenue. He is the project organizer for this event, Convert Capitol Avenue. Fun comments or suggestions you're getting so far?
So we have a community engagement board down here, and we've really encouraged people to think as big as possible with their ideas. I've seen a zip line. I've seen a community beer garden. I've seen all kinds of crazy ideas. But the important thing is it's getting people inspired, and it's getting them to really think about what they want in a downtown. And even if some of those really over-the-top ideas don't come about, I think a lot of the smaller great ideas will.
Zip line. There's already scaffolding at the top of the dome. You could probably stretch. No.
Yeah, I think we might concern the Capitol people just a little bit if we tried wiring a zip line.
Derek Tisler is a legislative assistant with the Michigan Municipal League, and we're on Capitol Avenue in front of the Capitol talking about parklets, and there are quite a few set up out here. Derek, thanks. What a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for coming down, helping to get the word out, and we're just really excited to work with so many great people on this event.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And coming up on Current State, the number of wolves on Michigan's Isle Royale is dwindling, and that has the National Park Service wondering about the animals' future on the island. We'll hear from Michigan Technological University Professor Rolf Peterson about the options for moving forward. Plus, roller coasters by the lake, summer homes, and resort hotels on the shore. If you're picturing Cedar Point, guess again. This was Hazlitt, Michigan, more than 100 years ago. We'll talk about the early days of Meridian Township with Jane Rose, Executive Director of the Meridian Historical Village. That and more after this break.
Got a heart that's broken hearted. How can I mend it? I got a crying jag you started. How can I end it? But if you're feeling gloomy, come a running to me. Meet me where they play the blues.
The acoustic stylings of East Lansing guitarist Ray Camillay there. Ray joined us for a Live Music Friday earlier this year. Tune in tomorrow when Nashville-based Americana singer Fawn Lawson stops by Studio S before her show at Midtown Brewing Company on Friday night. Another Current State Live Music Friday is on tap tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us today on Current State. Summer books usually bring to mind lighter fare, a page-turning mystery or a paperback romance maybe, but for those who don't mind a heavier read this summer, our book reviewer Scott Southard gives us his take on The Given World by Marion Pelea.
Reading a novel about loss and grief is never easy. Typically, we like to read stories with heroes, hope, and happy endings. But in the real world, and in the book The Given World by Marion Pelea, that is not always how things turn out. It takes some artistic flair to convey such heavy topics while moving the plot forward and keeping the readers engaged. Pelea takes on this challenge, creating a unique work with some powerful moments and a lot of heart. There are three main characters haunting the pages of The Given World. The first one is Riley. When we meet her, she is 9 years old. She is energetic and adventurous, and she spends her days roaming the fields of her family farm in Montana. She is obsessed with her older brother, Mick. Riley is always underfoot, watching him fix his bike and peppering him with questions. That is, until another character enters the story. That character is Vietnam. In 1968, Mick goes missing in Vietnam, changing Riley's life forever. The loss is too much for Riley to handle, since Mick was everything to her. Soon, Riley leaves her family and begins traveling the country. She takes occasional odd jobs as a newspaper deliverer, a factory worker, and a bartender, but she is always wondering what happened to her brother. At one point, she actually travels to Vietnam looking for him. Riley is not a character that's easy to understand, since she shares little with the people she meets on her adventures. Those characters recognize her fragility, and many make an effort to save her from herself. That is not to say readers will like the character of Riley. She abandons everyone in time, family, friends, and even a baby. When things get hard, she leaves. She dives into drugs and drinking, anything she can find to dull her pain. Yet, like other characters in the novel, a part of you will want to help her, seeing the lost potential hiding under her grief. The Given World is a book about war, but not in the way you might think. It doesn't focus on battles or wartime casualties, but on the scars of the other survivors, those left behind after the battles and the losses. You see those scars in Riley, but also the people that she meets in Vietnam. The pain of losing a loved one is universal. Everyone in the novel seems to be dealing with loss and struggling to understand why it happened. In the end, the characters don't find all the answers they are looking for, but they do learn how to live with their questions. The Given World by Marian Pelea is not the kind of book you'll want to read on the beach or bring along for long flights or car rides. This is a book for quiet moments of contemplation. The messy uncertainty of the characters' lives might not be what you're expecting out of a typical novel, but somehow that messiness still feels familiar. I can't guarantee that there is a happy ending waiting for every character in The Given World, but that is a lot like life in our Given World too, isn't it? For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
And Scott Southard is the author of the new novel Permanent Spring Showers and A Jane Austen Daydream. You can follow his writing via his blog, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard, at sdsouthard.com. It's WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. The future of the wolves of Isle Royale National Park is in question. The National Park Service is taking public comment for another month about the situation. Current State's Melissa Benmark has more. What's happening, Melissa?
Well, there have been a number of public meetings. Those were mostly this week and in the Upper Peninsula. But the public comment meeting online is open until the end of August. Basically, the situation is there's just three wolves left on the island. The moose population is soaring. Fewer natural predators. The way forward as to what to do about all this has not been decided. Well, earlier this week, I spoke with Rolf Peterson. He's the Michigan Technological University professor of wildlife ecology who's been studying the changing wolf and moose populations for decades.
Well, wolves and moose have been fluctuating for the whole last half century. They've been counted each year since 1959. The wolves have ranged between a high of 50 to the current low, which is just 3, an average about 23 or so. And then moose have fluctuated between just 500 and 2,500, and the average about 1,100 or so. Right now, there are 1,250 moose, approximately, and then just 3 wolves. The moose are increasing very dramatically, and the wolves are on their last legs, I'd have to say.
My understanding is that the wolves are relatively recent, but have the moose always been, or at least in terms of human history, been on Isle Royale?
Well, there's no historical records of moose prior to the early 1900s. And so they've been on the island. They got over to the island somehow in the early 20th century, and so they've been there over 100 years. Wolves have been there since the late 1940s in this last go-around. They may have been there in the past, but there is no historical record.
So I understand that Michigan Tech University has been doing this research project on Isle Royale, and that it's the longest continuous study of predator-prey systems pretty much in the world. Talk about the value of something like that to the scientific community.
Well, Isle Royale is a system where we aren't hunting wolves and moose. We're not killing them, and we're not harvesting the forest. And that combination is not found anywhere else in the world. And it also has the attributes of being a relatively simple, with just a single predator and single prey. So it's a simple system. The animals significantly are stuck there. They can't come and go readily, and that makes our annual counts much more meaningful in terms of understanding what the population processes are going on. That combination of circumstances is not found anywhere else in the world.
What factors do you think have been most responsible for the decline in wolf population over the last few years?
Well, the reason the wolves are in such poor shape now and declining quickly is inbreeding. What's led to the inbreeding is a declining frequency of ice bridges that connect Isle Royale to the mainland. And in past decades, that gene flow was maintained by the wolves themselves, who came and went across that ice at a very, it was quite rare. In fact, we are only aware of two or three cases in which wolves have gone one way or the other, and only two cases in which they've come in, well, three cases where they've come from the mainland to the island. And that was that rare but a significant gene flow which kept the population from becoming severely inbred as it is now. So in the 1960s, we had perhaps ice bridges 4 years out of five, and now it's less than 1 year out of 10.
So essentially, the refresher of new wolves coming across from the mainland is just not happening.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's a genetic refresher.
Explain to us the nature of the debate. I know there's some public comment periods now. About the future of the wolves on Isle Royale. Some people want to let nature take its course. Some people are talking about what can we do to save the wolves or increase the wolves. Can you kind of tell us what sides are saying in this debate?
Well, I guess the those that would argue against any intervention would be putting all their money on the wilderness, extreme wilderness interpretation, where they believe humans have absolutely no role in wilderness areas. The let nature take its course is a kind of a cute phrase, but it implies something pretty profound, and that is that we aren't natural, that humans aren't natural. If we're not natural, what are we, actually? It's a profound philosophical debate that's been going on for centuries, so we're not going to solve that in the next 30 days. But the Wilderness Act, which is the federal legislation that establishes the possibility of designated wilderness, does not say that humans have no role in wilderness. It was intended to limit development of wilderness areas, keep modern civilization out of wilderness, roads particularly, wheeled vehicles, that sort of thing. It never had the intent to restrict natural processes. In fact, the word untrammeled is key in the Wilderness Act, and the dictionary definition means unrestricted. So we don't want to restrict nature, and wolves are the most natural thing for moose there is. And predation is a key natural process. So I think the wilderness purists have simply misinterpreted the Wilderness Act. In terms of science and ecological health, the appropriate thing to do would be to get the wolf population going as soon as possible. And it doesn't require constant maintenance. I mean, you can monitor genetic viability maybe once every 20 years or so. You should need to dump another wolf out there. But it's nothing that's terribly interventionist at all.
What are the ramifications of having a moose population that does not have any natural predators on Isle Royale?
Oh, the increase without limits imposed by predators, at least, and they're limited ultimately by starvation and severe degradation of the habitat. And you can look around North America for a few national parks, particularly in Canada, where that is the case. Moose populations without wolves or without bears. And there is severe degradation of the forest, elimination of some plant species. The moose themselves suffer nutritionally and developmentally from poor nutrition. And so, actually, in Parks Canada, where they don't have the option, in some cases, of introducing wolves, they've taken to shooting moose, involving helicopters and everything they can to get moose density down from its unreasonably high level, where it's doing a lot of damage.
Are you willing to share what your thoughts are on what you feel ought to happen on Isle Royale?
Oh, sure. I've made no secret of that. I mean, for years, my colleague John Vustich and I have tried to encourage the Park Service to do a genetic rescue, which 2, 3, 4 years ago would have been quite easy to do just by introducing a wolf or two from the mainland that would mate with resident wolves. And the recessive genes that are expressed now would be hidden and masked and not operational. But now it's too late for genetic rescue of that sort. So now I would recommend just getting that wolf population restarted as soon as possible, which would mean bringing breeders over, males and females both, from the mainland.
So rather than refreshing the population, you're actually relocating a population.
Yeah, and if you could do that before all the wolves are completely gone, there's a chance that some of the resident wolves might eventually breed with newcomers. But the time is pretty short for that to happen.
Folks who are into nature and into Isle Royale, if the wolves come up, Rolf Peterson comes up, your name comes up. You are the face of the wolves on Isle Royale, I guess, the human face for a lot of people. And you've written and done interviews and been in publications. And it looks, just looking at your materials, that you've spent a heck of a lot of your life on this project. But you're in your 60s now. So where does this go after you retire? Or don't you retire?
Oh, I actually retired formally 9 years ago. But
oh.
I'm still involved as a research professor. My successor is John Vucetich, who's currently at Michigan Tech. So I have no concerns about the research itself being able to continue as long as there's a predator-prey system there to study.
Not too long ago, I believe it was Senator Tom Coburn was quoted as saying that Isle Royale was a waste of money. Do you worry about that kind of sentiment?
Well, I think he was referring to the annual budget for Isle Royale National Park and the number of visitors that go to Isle Royale. That's always been a challenge, I think, for the Park Service because it is the least visited national park, certainly in the lower 48. But one of the prime values of the park, actually, is science. The National Park Service is not the primary funder of science, wolf-moose science at Isle Royale, and a very small portion of its budget is devoted to that. So I don't think Senator Coburn knows much about wolves and moose at Isle Royale or what the actual resource allocation might be for that, for science there. Well, there is certainly a significant value of Isle Royale for people that never go there, just the contemplative value of knowing there's a place where wolves and moose coexist and carry on their evolutionary interactions without being killed by people.
Well, Rolf Peterson, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
You bet. Take care. Thanks very much.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And you can find a link to the National Park Service public comment area by going to isleroyalwolf.org and click on the link on the lower left of the page. Remember that royal is spelled with an E on the end. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. 200 years ago, few Europeans had ever seen Michigan's forest interior inland from the Great Lakes. In 1836, driven by the prospect of cheap land, white settlers first arrived in mid-Michigan. Farming and fur trading flourished in what's now Meridian Township. The region continued to grow after Michigan's capital moved from Detroit to Lansing in 1847. A new book due out next month chronicles the early history of Meridian Township. Jane Rose is the executive director of the Meridian Historical Village and the author of a book simply titled Meridian Township. It's part of the very cool Images of America series from Arcadia Publishing, which has occupied altogether too much of my time in one bookstore or the other. I love that series. Jane Rose, welcome to Current State.
Thanks, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Meridian was created as a township in 1842, and as we said, you're the executive director of the Meridian Historical Village, located right next to the township's administrative offices on Marsh Road. For people who've never visited the historical village, what buildings have been preserved there? What story do you try to tell there?
Well, what happened was back in the 70s, during the time of urban renewal, so many of our historic buildings were being torn down and replaced by modern structures. So the township, Meridian Township, asked for a study of all of the buildings within the township that were of historic significance. And as a result of that, the Friends of Historic Meridian, the organization was formed in 1974. And we began identifying historic buildings that were in risk of being torn down. And we rescued them, and we relocated them to Central Park in Okemos and restored them. So we have a nice little village right now that includes a farmhouse and barn and the whole farmstead community there. We have a rural one-room schoolhouse. We have an inn and tavern, a general store, and the only remaining toll gate house left in the entire state of Michigan. We also have a little log cabin that came to us through the Hazlitt Middle School, which was used for many years with the Pioneer Living and Outdoor Education Program.
Very nice.
So it's a lovely little village there.
Meridian Township is really a tale of two cities, if you will, or villages, if you will, Hazlitt and Okemos, and they had very different origins. Hazlitt was named for an interesting businessman who arrived in the 1880s. Tell us about him.
Yes, James Hazlitt. He was a haberdasher from Port Huron. Haberdasher is one who makes hats. But he was also very involved in the spiritualist movement in the 19th century, especially around the time of the Civil War. So many people lost loved ones that there became a growing movement to try to maintain contact with the loved ones who had died. And Mr. Hazlitt was very active in that whole movement. So he purchased some property on the southwest corner of what was then called Pine Lake. We now call it Lake Lansing. He was instrumental in bringing nationally known spiritualists to the area. And every summer, they had a six-week camp there with lessons and lectures and so on. Eventually, the spiritualist lecture hall became the Dodgem building when it became the Lansing Amusement Park. Yes.
Life
continued on for that.
An interesting transition for that structure. How did the community of Hazlitt grow to accommodate this resort status that it acquired?
Yes. Well, you know, it originally just started as a crossroads at the railroad that is still there, the railroad tracks that run right through Hazlitt.
Mm-hmm.
And just a few little businesses started popping up right around the railroad agent's office. And that grew a little bit, but it was mostly a farming town until the spiritualist camp was located there. And then the whole area in the southwest corner began to grow and develop, and little cottages were built for the summer visitors. And then more property was acquired by Mr. Hazlitt to make larger hotels. And that's really what prompted the beginning of Lake Lansing or Pine Lake as a summer resort center. If you think about living there in the 1880s and 1890s or in the greater Lansing area, very hot. Obviously, we didn't have air conditioning at that time. During the summer, you would try to spend your as much time on a lake area. And Pine Lake was and continues to be the largest body of water in the entire Ingham County.
Mm-hmm. And I see, I didn't know until I started planning for our interview here that R.E. Olds had a summer home to escape the heat on the north side of the lake.
Yes. He also was one of the individuals who created a men's club, and they had their own private club right out in the middle of the lake. It was called the Izzer Club.
I love that. We're talking with Jane Rose, the executive director of Meridian Historical Village. Jane's written a new book that will be on sale in mid-August, simply called Meridian Township, and it's part of the Images of America series that every bookstore aficionado has seen at Schuller Books and elsewhere. That's from Arcadia Publishing. Let's move south now to the other side of the township. Today we know it as Okemos, but that wasn't its original name. Okemos actually got started as Hamilton. How did Hamilton get started?
Well, that was for Alexander Hamilton. What happened was the very first white settler in the Okemos area was Sanford Marsh, and he had his log cabin on the south side of the Red Cedar River, right across from the current Okemos Central Montessori. And he was the very first, but then within a year, Freeman Bray, who was a Canadian who had escaped from the Canadian Patriots War in the 1830s, he resettled to this area, and he purchased the property just on the north side of Red Cedar. And he took the southeast portion of his acreage, platted it out to sell because land was cheap here in mid-Michigan. It was called Michigan Fever. That was how cheap the land was. Mm. And he actually became the first real estate agent in the area. I'm sure Martha will appreciate that tidbit.
My wife, the real estate agent. That's
yes.
Right. Well, and I understand Hamilton began under more humble circumstances. It didn't have the luster that Hazlitt had that we referred to earlier.
Yes, absolutely. When you are a pioneer, you're going to always try to locate near bodies of water. And so the first community located near Pine Lake, and that eventually became Hazlitt. Well, south of that, you have the Red Cedar River. There's something else that was significant about that location that we now call Okemos. It was actually the intersection of several Indian trails. And so you had beaten paths that helped you to get to that area, and you also had trading opportunities. Freeman Bray eventually wound up trading with Chief Okemos and his band of Indians.
Mm. Meridian Township also has what's probably the closest thing to a ghost town. It's a little place called Meridian Post Office.
Yes.
And it's easy to miss. What was that and where are we talking
Very
about?
Very easy to miss, but it is still remnants of it are still there. If you travel Meridian Road south from Grand River, you will go across the railroad tracks on the south side. And right at the railroad tracks, you'll see four or five buildings that used to be a little community. The chapter that I've entitled it is The Forgotten Hamlet. It did grow to a certain size, large enough to justify having its own church there. And then as other areas in the township continued to grow, such as Hazlitt and Okemos, which were much closer to transportation, and the Grand River road to Detroit, the growth of Meridian Post Office dwindled off. And so the church was torn down, and the community is now just a little tiny bedroom community.
Mm. We're talking with Jane Rose, the executive director of Meridian Historical Village. She's the author of a new book detailing the history of Meridian Township called, simply, Meridian Township. The township's 175th anniversary is the year after next, 2017. Any plans?
Well, I can't speak for the township, but we're certainly going to try to encourage them to make a big deal of that because it is significant. This whole township has a rich history. We have so many pioneers that really fought the battles in the wilderness of the forests. And all Meridian Township residents should be very proud of what we have done in that remaining time period and the stewardship that the township and the Parks and Recreation Department really have shown in taking care of our land,
the land preservation programs, the parks that we have here that attract so many people to the area, the commitment by the township towards the services. So I'm really hoping that we can work with the township and the Parks and Recreation Department in the next couple of years to really highlight our rich history.
We've been talking with Jane Rose, Executive Director of Meridian Historical Village. Jane's the author of a new book that will be on sale in mid-August, simply called Meridian Township. It's a part of the popular Images of America series from Arcadia Publishing. Very interesting stuff, Jane. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Mark.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, the Capitol might be a little emptier in the summer months, but there's still plenty of political news to discuss. Join Capitol reporters Tim Skubick and Susan J. Demas with me on Current State's monthly Month in Review, this time for July, of course. Plus, Fawn Lawson describes herself as an Americana alt-country indie rock singer. The Nashville-based artist will stop by Studio S to play her unique blend of those styles before her show tomorrow evening at Lansing's Midtown Brewing Company. Hope you can join us. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery for engineering and producing segments today. You don't have to be next to a radio to listen to the latest edition of Current State. Grab it and go. Just subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we're on social media. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State, on Facebook, Current State from WKAR. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you tomorrow on Current State from WKAR.